You are tuned into Express Yourself, and this is DJ Mama Bird, and I am thrilled to introduce our guest today, Alana Rocklin, bassist for STS9, or Soundtribe Sector 9, Tribe Sector 9, however you want to refer. Alana has been a member of the band for about 7 years now, and we are thrilled to have her time right here on KD&K. Hi, Alana.
Hey, Allie. Great to be here.
And thank you so much for being with us here. And while I feel like most of our listeners almost need no introduction from you, let's do have you introduce yourself and tell us how you got into playing music and when did you ultimately make this your career?
Well, let's see. I started playing the bass when I was about 8 years old. My dad gets all the credit for that. He wanted everybody to choose an instrument that year, and I wanted to play the drums, but he said no.
Oh my god!
So I don't know why I said the bass. I knew someone that was playing the bass at the time, someone I thought was super cool, and so I just said the bass, and I got an electric bass, started learning how to read music and take lessons and stuff.
Wow!
And when I was 10 years old, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee when I was 10 and started playing upright bass. So I've pretty much been, playing music my entire life.
Yeah.
And went to University of Michigan to study music there. And after, while I was in school, I started to really make some money playing music,
mm-hmm.
Pay my rent and stuff like that. So just, right as I was kind of graduating college and from there, and I just kind of started trying to make it happen.
Wow. And where did you go to school? You have a degree in music, is that correct?
Yeah, I went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Go Blue. My big fan of Michigan. Most fans actually know that.
Yes, yes.
But I went there originally to study classical music. I thought I wanted to be in an orchestra for a living.
Wow.
And it kind of quickly from got there and realized that, no, that's not really my calling, and started studying jazz and ended up getting a degree in jazz and improvisation.
Wow. So that has been a part of your life. And while this seems like so long ago, you joined STS9 in 2014 with your official show in March of that year as their new bassist after the exit of David Murphy. And you had played with STS9 for sit-ins and such many times before, so likely you knew what you were getting yourself into and what their intense family-like fan base was and is like. What was that process like, accepting that position into the band, and how were you feeling about that during sort of a really sensitive transition time for the band and their fans?
Yeah, we met in 2001, and, my husband Brad and I had a group then,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up opening a show for those guys in Chicago, where we were living at the time. And we just became really close friends, like right off the bat. We just connected. It was just one of those things where
right.
we really fell in love with what they were doing. They really respected what we were doing. And so we just started to kind of form a relationship, friendship. And, from that point in time, we were always connected in some way. We would open shows, or if we were in Nashville, and so whenever they would come to Nashville or Bonnaroo or whatever, we would always hang out, play music for each other, kind of just, had that friendship going. And so on top of that, we were fans of STS9, and so we would see shows, and I think we opened two entire tours where we, opened all the shows for like 6 weeks,
right.
So there was already like a really great relationship, friendship there. And when they needed a new bass player, it was, some people have auditions, some people, people do it in all kinds of different ways, but
sure.
this was more of an organic situation where it was like, we were friends, we knew each other, and so me being kind of aware of not even just aware, but just, you know, a part of the fans. You know, I was a fan myself, and I understood, of course, you know, how the fans, how they were feeling during that time. Mm-hmm. I could relate to that. You know, I could totally understand what shoes I was filling, how big of a situation that was. And I also knew the ethos of the band, you know, in a really deep way. So I feel like that was part of the reason why they asked me to do it in the first place, was just because I already had that understanding and could approach it in a really sensitive way.
Sure.
And, you know, I was already, I'd been touring, you know, and doing all that for years and years. So that was also part of it, was just sort of just the notion that that's what I had been doing for other artists. So I think it was just really natural. We tried to make it about the music. You know, I came out to play that first show. We hadn't announced that I was going to be there or anything. It was just kind of like, this is, you know, we're going to make this about the music and about what we're playing and what we're doing on stage, and not about like all this other, you know, stuff on the outside.
Right.
So, you know, but it was a big deal, of course, you know, and I fully understood how deep that was and that transition was.
Yeah. And it's really amazing, you know, that this organic thing happened, because it seems like that is sort of like the theme of the band anyways, is this tight family like, you know, theme or group that has formed this style of fan base. And STS9, a band that started in 1998 with 11 albums and 2 remix albums and a heavy touring schedule, has hundreds of songs, with many of them being improvs and many that changed their course over time. What was that like, sort of learning all of those songs and songs that have been shelved and songs that are improvised? You know, what is that like for a new member of the band?
Well, that's a great question. You know, as I kind of mentioned, what I had been doing. You know, I would get calls from people and they would say, I might get a call from somebody that said, you know, I need you to learn 30 songs tomorrow, you know, the bus is leaving. So I was already really, I'd been working on that skill for many, many years of just learning songs really fast. So there was that. And then there's also, of course, the fact that I had been around the band and was familiar with the songs. I wouldn't say I was familiar with them in terms of playing them, you know, and I'm not, so there was definitely a lot to learn there, but I was familiar, you know, with the aesthetic, with what the songs were, and that was good. But when I, you know, when I got the call to join the band, as I said, I was living in Nashville at the time. So I said, you know, let me take a couple weeks, like, give me your top 50 songs. Give me the top 50 songs that you guys play, and I'll start there. And so I learned, you know, 50 songs to start. And that's when we first played together the very first time, you know, rehearsing, that's what I came in with.
Wow.
So that felt really good, because I had that sort of basis. And then it was just about adding songs from there. And so, you know, that first summer we played mostly festivals, and there was generally every show maybe one song that was new to me.
Okay.
One or two. So with that 50 as my basis, that's where I started. And we would just kind of keep adding them and keep adding them. Now, there were songs that I loved that they didn't play anymore, so I would kind of bring those up. You know, like, hey, what about this song? What about that song? And sometimes they would just be like, oh, man, we forgot about that song.
Right.
Yeah, like, we should play it, you know, because there are so many. And it's hard to kind of keep track of maybe what the fans are into or what songs slip away. And so it was I felt like it went really smooth for me, because I had that 50 to start out with. And I think by the time we got through like that fall tour of 2014, we were way over 100 songs at that point.
Amazing.
Built up. But everybody was really gracious and helped me learn them and, you know, went over them as much as I needed. And but I also really, I approached it kind of like how I approached, you know, learning a jazz standard, where you kind of, you listen to the first recorded work. You know, you might listen to what people, what fans think are the definitive version of that song, what the newest version of that song is. And so I really studied that, you know, I took pride in that. That song, like Moonsocket, you know, through the years, it evolves and changes, mm-hmm. you know. So I wanted to make sure that I was, like, kind of coming in with understanding of all the years, like all the versions. And I think that also helped kind of give the authenticity to what I was doing and how I could, you know, make the songs feel like, you know, like they were meant to be. So
right. Well, I thank you for unshelving songs because, you know, we always have, you know, those songs that we've been chasing for so many years. And it's just really amazing to hear them change over the course of time. Do you have a favorite song, or is there a song that's been one of your biggest challenges to play or to learn?
Oh, man, that's a good question. People ask me all the time, and Reemergence is, like, always been one of my mm-hmm. favorite songs. Like, mm-hmm. before I joined the band, that was kind of, like, my song. Like, if I was at a show and they played that, I love that song, and I love playing that song. And I would say the hardest song to learn was definitely Tap In, because I'm not, Murph and I would always joke with him about that song. Like, yeah, I'm not going to learn that song. I don't even know how to tap. Like, tapping was just not something I was, like, wanting to get into or do or anything. So when that kind of came up, you know, I had to do a little extra work on that one. But other than that, you know, it was, it felt pretty seamless as these things go, you know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to learn that many songs. It's hard to keep them all organized in your mind. And of course, like, you know, my goal was also that I didn't want to have any music or anything in front of me. You know, I wanted to know them all, you know, in my heart. So you know, I think it all went super smooth, all things considered, but I did put a lot of work into it ahead of time. And so I think that really helped.
Now, I have a question that's sort of off the roster, but the energy at an STS9 show, if you've ever been to one, is really kind of an indescribable feeling. And that's something that you all are sort of orchestrating when you're on the stage. If you do look out at the crowd at a certain point and it's obvious you can feel what they're feeling, does that sort of change the way you play, or does that take a new direction on stage? I mean, what is that like?
Oh man, it's totally indescribable how that feels, you know, when you're in that moment. But there is this synergy that happens, and it's definitely something that we're trying to cultivate. Mm-hmm. But it's not something you can force, right? It's a very it has to be genuine, right?
You have to feel it.
It has to kind of happen. So I think that, you know, there's a certain amount of, like, you know, we have to be kind of tapped into each other. Mm-hmm. We have to be in the right frame of mind, you know, with each other in order to send that out to the audience. But they always give it back. And there's definitely a lot of times where, like, maybe for whatever reason, we're not in that zone or tapped into that as we want to be. Sometimes what we do is the opposite, is just use the energy of the crowd to get us there.
Okay.
So it really is like it's so cool.
Yeah.
How that happens. And it does feel like it's both sides. You know, it feels that way to us just probably as much as it might feel on the other side.
Right.
That is what we're always trying to get to. You know, that's the elusive thing that, you know, you're trying to tap into every time, you know. And
yeah. Quite euphoric.
It feels really incredible.
Well, before you joined the band, you had your own band with your husband Brad called Sub-ID, which I've actually seen Sub-ID many times. And I remember during a 5-night run over New Year's in Atlanta at the Tabernacle, Sub-ID was also the first band to put out an album with STS9's label 1320 Records. Do you and Brad still find time to play together?
Definitely, yes. You know, Brad is our engineer for STS9 in the studio. He does all of our studio stuff, and he does all of the band camp recordings and all that he's in charge of. But we, as a unit, still play all the time. We're actually right now we you know, during this pandemic, it's always been our thing to want to do some streaming, and so we're finally now in a place where we can do that, and we're going to be doing that really soon. Start, you know, doing shows of our own from our house and broadcasting them. So we're really excited about that. We just came out with a remix of is the Sub ID remix that we did of Peace Blaster, but we had everybody in SPS9 also play on it. That just came out. So we're always working on things. Everybody should look for that, because we're going to be doing a bunch of streaming and a bunch of shows like from our house, and we're super stoked about that.
Wow,
so
we will be excited about that. Well, I want to talk about what it's like to be the only female in an all-male band. And as someone that may be biased, I can, however, say that anyone who has seen you play live in person has witnessed your immense, fierce talent and true dedication to the art form of playing music. But do you feel like your role in the band takes on a different aspect, being the only female? Do you feel more pressure? It seems so inspiring to any young female trying to get into the world of playing music. Is that something that you think about?
Well, you know, I really owe a lot of that fierceness and kind of just, you know, ability to do that to my parents, because I never knew that it was something I should even consider, like being a female playing the bass, or it wasn't something at, you know, as I started playing it when I was 8 years old, that anyone ever clued me into that I should be thinking is strange. So I, as a child, like, never thought anything of that. So I play the bass. That's what I do. That's what I love to do. And, you know, it wasn't until I got older that started to kind of creep in, where, you know, I remember a couple times playing in college, like playing master classes for, you know, really well-known musicians, and them kind of,
sure,
you know, me thinking I was going to get some kind of musical feedback, but what I got was like, you know, you're not going to be able to do this for a career. You know, you're a female. Mm-hmm. That whole thing is kind of interesting, because I've always had people around me that support what I do. My husband, 100%. Like, we've known each other since we were 19 or 20.
Wow.
And so, yeah, he's always, that's never been a thing for him. Like, it was never anything I clued into until I got older and tried to have more of a career of it, and then it became like a something that I had to kind of pay attention to. In SPS9, you know, it was always something that, you know, the other four members, I think, thought of as a positive, you know, to have female energy, to have that perspective. And so that always felt really encouraged, you know, and like, you know, we want that. The logistics of being a female on the road, yeah, you definitely have to deal with some stuff that, mm-hmm, maybe, you know, is unique to that situation.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, the only female on a bus, you know, living with other guys. And obviously, SPS9 was the first of that scenario for me. Most of the time that, you know, I've played music on the road, it's been with guys. You know, I think I can think of one time that I toured with an all-female group. And other than that, you know, I'm usually the only one. Now, I think that most of the time that I've been in those situations, it's because people want me there. You definitely will encounter people that will, you know, discourage it, you know, and I definitely encounter that. The other thing that I always, you know, that still cracks me up, and I'm sure every female musician can attest to it, is that, like, you'll be the one that can't get into your own show, or, you know, like, you're walking up to a festival stage and, like, the four guys in front of me were walking and they'll stop me, like, hey, what are you doing? Like,
wow. You know? Wow.
So that happens. It still happens. It still is, like, you know, cracks me up, or I'll be standing. I used to tour with Jeff Coffin, and he's a saxophonist for Bela Fleck and then Dave Matthews now. But there was a really funny time I was on the road with him. And I guess I didn't have my pass on me. I, like, walked out of the club, didn't have my pass, and I was trying to get back in. And the show was about to start, and I could not. They wouldn't let me in. They, mm-hmm, thought I was, like, lying. You know, I'm like, no, I swear to God, like, I got to get in there. You got to, you know, and I'm calling. And, of course, everybody's on stage. They're ready to play, so no one's paying attention to their phone. And yeah, so those things still happen. And
that's an amazing
story. But you know, I feel really supported in what I do, and I think that's really just a testament to the people that I have surrounding me, and you know, I'm thankful for that.
Wow.